The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third row seating, available dual wireless charging pads. You've got the H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on those dirt trails and kick up some mud. Or the third row seating gets your whole family in to experience the thrill together. The dual wireless charging pads make sure that no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead cell phone. Think about those adventurous activities you can do, like me, taking a ski trip up with the family, maybe going on a camping expedition, anything and everything. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
Hey there, it's Gary Parrish. It's Monday, June 27, 2022. Welcome back to the CBS Sports Eye on College Basketball Podcast, where we sometimes discuss camel fighting, dodo birds, and leaky black. David Cobb is here with me. If you're watching live on YouTube or later on YouTube, please smash the like button like you're Brandon Davies. You have consent. And as you know, late last week, we officially put the 2022 NBA draft in the rearview mirror. For the 13th straight year, a college freshman was the number one pick, this time Paolo Banchero. But six of the 14 lottery picks were prospects who spent at least 2 years playing college basketball. They were Keegan Murray, Jaden Ivey, Benedict Mathurin, Johnny Davis, Jalen Williams, and Ochai Agbaji. So with this in mind, I wanted to start this episode with a conversation about which multi-year college players could turn into lottery picks next year, which is honestly a tough conversation to have, because even though multi-year college players do become lottery picks, like literally every year, they're typically difficult to identify 12 months out. If they were easy to identify 12 months out, they would have probably just been in the NBA draft. Like the Paolo Banqueros, the Chet Holmgrens, those are easy to identify 12 months out. We already know Victor Wembanyama and Scoot Henderson are going to be lottery picks next year. But which players did we just watch play in college and who are returning to college, you know, which players could join them in the lottery next year? David Cobb, he put together a list in recent days. You can find it at CBSSports.com. So let me ask you this. If you had to bet 10 paychecks on which non-freshman college player will be a lottery pick next year, where would you place your money?
Well, obviously, Leaky Black is number one. But after Leaky Black, I think I'd probably go Chris Murray, because his identical twin just went in the lottery. And Chris Murray is a similar player. They're not the same player. I don't necessarily believe that Chris Murray is going to average, you know, 23.6 points a game or whatever it was that Keegan averaged this past year at Iowa. But he's a versatile 6'8 forward who can do a whole lot offensively and who can guard pretty much 1 through 5 on the defensive end. And clearly that was attractive with Keegan Murray. Now with Keegan Murray departing, Chris Murray is going to have a huge year for Iowa next year. You know, Bohannon's finally gone as well. So a good bit of their offense is departing. And so that's going to open up the door for Chris Murray to probably be a 16, 17 points per game type of guy for Iowa next season. And yes, he'll be old. He'll be, I think, 23 opening night next year. But, or yeah, I guess 23 whenever he would play his first NBA game. So he's old, but like that didn't stop him from taking Keegan really high in the draft either. So I think Chris Murray is a pretty safe bet potentially to go in the first round next year.
He's certainly a reasonable place to start the list, or at least a reasonable person to put on a list when you're looking for multi-year college players who could be lottery picks. You know, shot nearly 40% from three on 3.2 attempts per game. So he's, 6'8", got good size, a reliable shooter. One of the issues, and as you know, this isn't an issue for me as much as it is for other people, but I acknowledge it is an issue for other people, including people who run NBA franchises. He turns 22 in August, like you said, would be 23 on opening night of his rookie season. Now, Ochai Agbaji just got picked in the lottery, and he's already 22 years old. Keegan Murray will be 22 on opening night of his rookie season. So it's not a deal breaker if you're, 22, 21, that you can't possibly go in the lottery, but it is something that often works against you. Some history real quick. I went and looked this up. In the past five NBA drafts, an average of 4.2 lottery picks per year have been prospects who spent at least two seasons playing college basketball. You had three lottery picks in 2018, six in 2019, six in 2020, four in 2021, six in this 2022 NBA draft. So even though I think you and I might struggle to come up with the six guys we're sure are going to be lottery picks who spent multiple years in college next year, like these players will emerge. They just do. Over the past 5 years, at least three in every lottery and as many as six, on average 4.2. By the way, the number one pick, like I said, has been a college freshman 13 straight years. Trivia time. Who was the last non-freshman to go number one?
The last non-freshman to go number one would have been, oh gosh, yeah, that's tough. That is tough. I'm going to forfeit my right to answer this question. What's the answer?
Blake Griffin in 2009. But he is the guy who you could actually project a year in advance that he would be a lottery pick, because he would have been a lottery pick if he left after his freshman season. He just came back to school. So he's a bit of an exception to the rule, because these days most lottery picks, projected lottery picks, do not come back to school. Only two multi-year college players. This sort of surprised me. Only two multi-year college players have gone number one in this century. Blake Griffin in 2009, Kenyon Martin in 2000. That's it. Everybody else has been an international player or a one and done.
It's also crazy that somebody who was drafted in this century already has a child playing in the NBA.
Yeah. So getting old, time flies and all that stuff. I went through your list of guys you thought had a chance to become lottery picks. And I know this sounds crazy given what we've seen of him over the past year, but I think if I were going to bet on somebody, I'd probably go with Amani Bates, just because I still like the talent is still there. The stuff that made him a projected lottery pick, at least in theory, before that disastrous season at Memphis, like that stuff's still there. And he's still only 18, doesn't turn 19 till January. He's still, you know, a long, skilled, shot-making wing. Obviously, like everybody else in the world, I think less of him today than I did a year ago today. But I'm not somebody who doesn't think there's any chance whatsoever Amani Bates regains a good portion of his reputation. Still trying to figure out what he's going to do over the next year, play college basketball, not play college basketball. If he plays college basketball, where is returning to Memphis legitimately on the table, like some have speculated that it is. But if you told me we're going to look up in January and Amani Bates is a meaningful college basketball player and reestablish himself as a legitimate lottery prospect, that wouldn't be the craziest thing in the world to me.
Not at all. Look at Peyton Watson going number 30 in this past draft out of UCLA. Very much a tools pick, an upside pick, and was less productive in his one season of college basketball than Amani Bates was last season. So with another year of college basketball under his belt, I can still see Amani Bates going in the lottery. Let me ask you this. If Amani Bates had been draft eligible last week, do you think he would have been taken?
Maybe in the second round. I don't think he would have been taken in the first round. I don't see how you could give him guaranteed money on a rookie scale. But I could see somebody just saying, what else are we going to do with the 38th pick? Like, who else are we getting with this? But let's just go ahead and take Amani Bates. I think he'd have been picked. I would be skeptical that it would have been in the first round.
Yeah, I think Amani Bates should do G League Ignite. Because if he goes to Louisville or he goes to Michigan or he comes back to Memphis, he's signing up for the same experience he just went through, which is being under the microscope at all times, which is having every possession scrutinized heavily, which is those expectations which he's had for the last 5 years continuing to follow him as he plays on national TV multiple days per week and plays in front of tens of thousands of fans in some cases. G League Ignite takes away all the frills. It still gets him a paycheck. It gets him a chance to develop outside that scrutiny, outside that pressure, outside that microscope. And it's a place where he can really just work on his game without having to deal with everything that Amani Bates has had to deal with for the last 5 or 6 years. And so to me, that feels like the most natural place for him, because he's not going to have a coach who tries to pigeonhole him into a certain role to fit the team need. He's going to be in a program that sole purpose is preparing him for the next level. So you look at guys like F.A. Abojidi, who plays a year at Washington State, then goes G League Ignite. What, that seems weird, but why can't Amani Bates do the same thing? Because it doesn't seem to me like college basketball is really going to be all that beneficial of an experience for him.
It's a totally reasonable option. If I were in the Bates camp, so to speak, I would certainly explore that. The only thing I would insist on is he's got to do something, and he's got to do something legitimate. You know,
maybe his dad can make a college.
Like, can't do that. Or, you know, Eastern Michigan has been connected on some level. With all due respect, I think he's got. If he hadn't just damaged his stock so badly in his 1 year at Memphis, then I would say do whatever you want, because your reputation is still intact. But he was so bad, I mean, and bad in a lot of different ways at Memphis, that he's got to – he can't do a Shaden Sharp and just say, oh, I'm a projected first-round pick. I'll just sit it out and somebody will pick me in the first round next year. He's got to – go prove himself against, I think, in a legitimate league and against legitimate competition. I don't care where that is, but I think that's what he has to do. And the G League Ignite would give him an opportunity to do that. And you know, being able to work, as Ja Morant might say, in the dark, could be beneficial for him. Like, yes, everybody who needs to see him from a "we have the power to take you" perspective We'll see plenty of Amani Bates if he were to be in the G League Ignite program, but like, we wouldn't be talking about him. Your casual college basketball fans or basketball fans in general wouldn't be watching him. Nobody really watches that stuff. And so it makes sense to me, but he does have to do something. He has to, whatever he does the next year, he has to be surrounded by legitimate comparable talent, or at least be in a league with comparable talent, legitimate NBA players, and he's got to perform. Otherwise, he will not, you know, get picked next year, because you could still give somebody the benefit of the doubt after one bad year under unusual circumstances. Reclassified, got to campus late, didn't have the normal summer prep that a college freshman would. Got, you know, just the whole spectacle that it was sometimes over the past year, the Memphis basketball program. Like, I can write off some of this stuff as, boy, it was just they were really trying to make something work that was going to have a hard time working. But if you're bad for two straight years, well, then you're probably, you know, you're probably just bad. Like, there are such things as breakthrough sophomore seasons. Jaden Ivey had one, Keegan Murray had one, Johnny Davis had one. But they were all at least respectable, like good as freshmen, and then really broke through as sophomores. You know, breakthrough junior seasons and breakthrough senior seasons for prospects, those are a little less common. And so,
Jake LaRavia would like a word with you.
He's a great example.
What the heck, man? Never would have seen him on the top. You know, wouldn't have even considered ranking him in the top 100 transfers, and then he breaks out. So, I mean, you never know. A lot of it depends on where Amani Bates would end up. I don't think Louisville is a great fit because they need another guard. And I'm like, we saw Amani Bates with the ball in his hands as a primary facilitator at Memphis. You know, he was trying to be that next Penny Hardaway, right? Penny was a tall point guard and was going to kind of shepherd that part of Amani Bates's game, and it really didn't work. And so I see a Louisville roster really in need of a ball handler and a guard. And I don't know if that's what you want Amani Bates to be doing next season if you're trying to showcase his game for NBA scouts. So even if he does go the college route, I feel like he's got to be real careful about the route that he chooses. I mean, Michigan seems like a reasonable fit because he could just go there and kind of be a guy, and they've got other talent around them. There wouldn't be a ton expected of him. It seems to me like he could go there, play between 19 and 25 minutes a night, more as an off-ball type of player and maybe work on that outside shot a little bit and maybe take on more of a 3-and-D role. That, to me, if he's going to stay in the college game, seems like the more beneficial route rather than, hey, Monty, you're the guy with the ball in your hands for us. We're trying to make the Sweet 16 this year, and good luck, you know?
Yeah, I don't think he needs to be the best player, the perceived best player on a team, because I don't know that he's good enough, or at least he didn't show it last season that he was good enough to be that. I don't really want the ball in his hands. You know, let's keep it simple. You're a wing with size who can shot create and shot make. Let's do that stuff. Let's get awesome at that stuff, and then we'll worry about trying to be a 6'8" point guard another time, because that whole – what's interesting about that, because when he enrolled at Memphis, that was the idea. And then they abandoned that for the most part within 2 weeks of practices. It wasn't even like they got to the games and they realized he can't play point guard. It was like, it was just obvious in the gym. Like, this is not what he's capable of doing right now. So I'd get back to playing to his strengths. Like, what are the things that made him one of the most 15-year-olds, one of the best 15-year-old prospects in recent history, 16-year-old prospects in recent history, 17-year-old prospects in recent history? You know, what are the things that he did to establish himself as a, you know, legitimate five-star prospect? Get back to doing those things and get back to doing them consistently. And then maybe you can get back to showing up in the lottery of mock drafts. But right now, I think most 2023 drafts would have him somewhere bottom of the first, early second. But again, he's so young and so talented, he's got an opportunity to improve on all that stuff. Some other guys that, if you're looking for multi-year college players who could, you know, over the next year develop into lottery picks, you mentioned Marcus Bagley at Arizona State, who is talented but just has barely played. And so that's an interesting name to keep an eye on. Matthew Cleveland at Florida State's, I think, a good name, just because, you know, he's a former five-star prospect who certainly fits the, falls under the description of guys who you could see having like real breakthrough, you know, next seasons. Nolan Hickman at Gonzaga, you had Tyrese Hunter as an honorable mention on your list. Caleb Love out of North Carolina, Terquavion Smith out of NC State, Julian Strother out of Gonzaga, Jalen Wilson out of Kansas. I know a lot of these sound, there's no way that guy could become a lottery pick. But if we were doing this a year ago and I said Johnny Davis out of Wisconsin, you'd have been like, what? How is Johnny Davis going to be a lottery pick? What are you talking about? And that's why, whether it's your list or anybody else's list, I don't say absolutely not to any of them. Because if we'd had this conversation last year and you said Johnny Davis out of Wisconsin, I would have said, absolutely not. That's crazy. Or Jalen Wilson out of Santa Clara, absolutely not. That's silly. And yet these are guys who just developed into lottery picks. The other ones who did, Keegan Murray was on NBA radar. It's like that I wouldn't have predicted lottery, or certainly not top five, but first round pick, maybe lottery. Yeah, that seemed possible. Jaden Ivey, I think people could see. Benedict Mathurin, maybe a little harder to see, but like, you, it, nothing crazy. Like, he at least 6'6 athlete. Like, you start there, you're in a pretty good spot. And Oche Agbaji, I could see that one. Maybe I wouldn't have predicted lottery, but it wasn't hard to envision maybe, just maybe, lottery. But Johnny Davis, Jalen Williams, those were the big surprises. Everybody would have said no way a year ago. So I'm not going to say no way to anybody, because that's a good way to end up on Old Takes Exposed for the 15,000th time.
And then look at later in the first round of this draft. You got Dalen Terry at 18. I mean, as recently as a month ago, first round seemed a little bit unlikely for him. He obviously was a late riser, but not somebody who really pops to sit statistically or even showed a whole lot as a freshman to make you think first round pick. Walker Kessler, I mean, I was really high on him in the transfer rankings, but I don't think there was a ton of certainty about his game from an NBA standpoint as he was transferring out from North Carolina to Auburn after barely playing, you know, as a true freshman. And then Wendell Moore Jr. went in the first round as well. So a lot of these guys I'm looking at, you know, and I'm seeing maybe mid to late first round possibilities as well, because you do really have to break through, I feel like, to get into the top 10 as a multi-year college player. And I think some of these guys could. I think Jalen Wilson is somebody in my mind who could be in line for that massive leap next year, because you're talking about the leading returning scorer for the defending national champions. And with Christian Brown gone, with Ochai Agbaji gone, they're not bringing in a ton of like ultra elite talent. Like, this is going to be another Bill Self team that isn't one and done oriented. And so he's going to be a guy who's got a chance to shine. And I think if Jalen Wilson improves his 3-point shooting from about 30% for his career so far to say, you know, say he shoots 36, 37% next year as a versatile 6'8 guy, I definitely could see him going in the lottery.
So if you haven't seen the list yet, you can find it at CBSSports.com. Some candidates, multi-year college players who could develop into lottery picks for the 2023 NBA draft. David Cobb posted it just after the 2022 NBA draft was wrapped up. The matchups for the ACC Big Ten Challenge have been set. We're going to run through those next. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
So the matchups for the ACC Big Ten Challenge have been set. Let me run you through them real quickly. On Monday, November 28th, we got two games. It'll be Minnesota at Virginia Tech, Pitt at Northwestern. On Tuesday, November 29th, Syracuse at Illinois, Maryland at Louisville, Penn State at Clemson, Virginia at Michigan, Wake Forest at Wisconsin, Georgia Tech at Iowa. And then Wednesday, November 30th, we get Purdue at Florida State, Ohio State at Duke, Rutgers at Miami, North Carolina at Indiana, Michigan State at Notre Dame, Boston College at Nebraska. So we've got a couple of matchups featuring two teams that are ranked in the preseason top 25 and one. That's number 24, Ohio State, at number 5, Duke. And then the biggest, and this is the best matchup I think we could have possibly gotten, number 2, North Carolina, at number 16, Indiana, because that is the team I think is going to be the preseason favorite in the ACC against the team I believe is going to be the preseason favorite in the Big Ten. What'd you make of these matchups? Anything stand out to you?
I love UNC at Indiana. It just got a lot of prestige to it. You think about, from a coaching standpoint too, a former NBA guys back at their alma maters, like, you know, Mike Woodson and Hubert Davis, like those guys are just like the symbols of their basketball programs on multiple levels. And so that's a really fun coaching matchup. You really think Indiana is going to be the preseason favorite to win the Big Ten?
I think so. I mean, based on what they're bringing back and what they're bringing in, I have them, I guess I'll put it this way. I have them as my highest ranked Big Ten team in the top 25 and one. I've got Indiana at 16, Purdue at 22, Michigan at 19, Ohio State at 24, Michigan State at 25. So it's close. I've got a bunch of Big Ten teams sort of, you know, you know, slotted pretty reasonably close to each other, you know, from 16 to 25. And then Illinois, that's a team I don't have in my top 25 and one that Illinois fans remind me of all the time. But certainly, you know, they don't bring back much from last year's roster, but you know, whether it's, you know, a talented freshman or the transfer portal, you know, they brought in they've got an interesting roster that could develop into, clearly has the potential to develop into a top 25 team.
Do you think the reason that Mike Woodson and his staff haven't taken any transfers is because they can't load the portal on their phones or their computers?
I don't know the explanation for that. The internet is working in Indiana. So I think once Trace Jackson Davis announced he was coming back to school, the internet kicked into high gear again in the state of Indiana. So I'm happy for those folks to be able to have, you know, high speed connections. And then, you know, we'll see how the season goes. But I do think on paper, Indiana looks like, you know, a slight favorite in the Big Ten. Sure.
I dig it. Man, I love the Race Thompson, Trace Jackson Davis front court. They've been together forever now. And I feel like they just need a chance to shine on the second weekend of the NCAA tournament, because they're a fun duo. They're both just guys that play really, really hard. I wish for the life of me that the Indiana staff would kind of cultivate and put in some stuff for TJD to hit some outside shots. The thing that worries me a little bit about Indiana, it's kind of like last year's Gonzaga team with, you look at Salas and who was the other freshman guard, but Nolan Hickman. You know, Indiana's going to be relying on two freshman guards, and they're really highly touted prospects, but they're not like in that top 10 can't miss, like definitely a future lottery pick range. You know, it's Hood Chilfino and Malik Reno, and they're both five-star guys. But, like, you know, Christian Lander was a five-star guy too, and that didn't really work out. And guard play's kind of been that bugaboo for Indiana. So I love the roster. I think the tools are there. I feel a little iffy on predicting them to win the Big Ten when you might be relying pretty heavily on two freshman guards.
I really like Hood Chilfino, like, a lot. I'm a believer in him. The point you make is a fair one, but like, I think he's going to be really good right from the jump. Like what I saw, and it was just on the EYBL circuit, and he played for Team Thad here in Memphis. So I went to a practice one day and watched him work out, and it was really clear, like, that's the best guy on the court. You know, when in practices, when they were scrimmaging, like, if you didn't know anything about anything, you walk in and you go, okay, that's the guy running. That's the guy running this thing. And I'll give his grassroots coach, Norton Hurd, a lot of credit, because at the time he was Hood Chilfino, like a four-star guy, and he was like, after Peach Jam, he'll be a five-star guy. Watch. He goes, when people see him again, he'll be a consensus five-star guy, and that is exactly what happened. He was really good on the EYBL circuit, really good at Peach Jam, and then I think, if I remember correctly, I think he got COVID at Peach Jam and had to miss, like, that was it. Like, he performed there, and then it was, like, over. You know, his grassroots career was just over thanks to a positive COVID test. But I'm a big believer in him. When they got him, I thought that was huge, and I think he'll be really good. One of the things that, I don't want to say it bugs me, because it really doesn't matter to me too much anymore, but one of the things I've always thought the ACC Big Ten Challenge should include from a maximizing coverage perspective, because, you know, you always hear from, you know, people who work in league offices, you know, when they're talking, you know, if you're in conversations with them, it's like, hey, you're going to try to make it to Duke Carolina game, or, you know, you're going to be on the road for this. You come into Champions Classic, that kind of stuff. I've always thought it would be really smart, and I've made this point years ago, it'd be really smart if they scheduled Duke and North Carolina to play home games 1 year, but make it the same year. And then alternate that with Michigan State playing home games together on back-to-back nights. In other words, every year, Duke and North Carolina should play at home, one on Tuesday, one on Wednesday. And then in the following year, Michigan and Michigan State should play home games on Tuesday and Wednesday. That way, if you're a national writer, you can fly into Raleigh and go to a Duke ACC Big Ten Challenge game on one night, and a North Carolina ACC Big Ten Challenge game the next night. And in the different year, you can fly into Detroit, I guess, and go to a Michigan Big Ten ACC Challenge game on a Tuesday night and a Michigan State Big Ten ACC Challenge game on a Wednesday night. They almost never line up like that. But like, I would intentionally line them up like that, because then, you know, you get people right now, like national writers might go, well, I don't know if it's worth going to Duke just to see Ohio State Duke. But what if you could see Ohio State Duke on a Tuesday and Indiana at North Carolina on a Wednesday? You might then go, okay, well, I'm knockout four elite teams in back-to-back nights with one flight. Let's go do that. I just think that's a missed opportunity. Not the biggest deal in the world. And it's possible I'm the only person who cares about it, but it's something I've always thought they should do.
I mean, you know, they really should call you before they finalize these things and make sure things align with your itinerary before they go through and publish them.
That's exactly right. I've always wondered why they don't check with me in advance to make sure this is sensible. Like, they get the matchups right, you know, often, but I think they just miss, if you're trying to get as many media members as possible to your games, having Duke and North Carolina at home in the same year on different nights and Michigan State at home in the same year on different nights. You know, anybody who would go to one of those games would go to both of those games. And some people who wouldn't go to just one of those games might be compelled to go if you could knock out two games on a Tuesday, Wednesday. I don't know. Just an idea. You can, they can take it or not take it, but I do
like the fact that this one is spread out over 3 days as opposed to the SEC Big 12 Challenge, which they cram into one day. And to the credit of the SEC and the Big 12, that does end up being the dominant storyline of that singular particular day. In was it usually February in college basketball that Saturday? But I like the idea of spreading it out over 3 days at a time when there's not really a whole lot else going on in college basketball, because these matchups do end up kind of dominating it. You could probably start out with something a little more appetizing than Minnesota, Virginia Tech, and Pitt, Northwestern. But, you know, I get it. They're going to put, you know, the games on Monday night that are up against Monday Night Football on that are, you know, less attractive, that you're not going to put your UNC Indiana game up against Monday Night Football, you know?
Right. I'd maybe put a more attractive game on Monday, but I think they're just trying to maximize the 2 days they have that aren't, you know, going head to head against Monday Night Football. Cause like, you and I are going to watch those games, but everybody else is watching football on Monday night. So I do get why Monday is by far the weakest day of the 3 day ACC Big Ten Challenge. It's interesting. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the SEC Big 12 Challenge, they haven't been able to make that matter from a who wins it perspective as much as the ACC Big 10 Challenge seems to matter to some. Like, that's always a thing heading into the ACC Big 10 Challenge. You know, we might get asked in a dribble handoff, so who you think's winning it this year, the ACC or the Big 10? And I've never been asked, I don't think. Who do you think wins this weekend's SEC Big 12 Challenge? I don't even think that's a thing.
Well, it's interesting now because literally two of the premier teams in the Big 12 are about to join the SEC. Right. So, you know, it's like, all right, we're coming for you this year, but then we're going to join you next year. So it's a little bit of an awkward dynamic there. And then the other thing with the SEC Big 12 Challenge is the SEC has an inherent advantage because on most years, four of their lesser teams aren't participating. And so with the way they do the schedule, you never know. It could be that one of the teams that gets left out from the SEC side of that event ends up having a surprisingly good team. But for the most part, it's the less attractive teams from the SEC that get scheduled out of that event. And so the Big 12, they have no choice but to put their bottom feeders out there. Granted, the Big 12 doesn't really have any bottom feeders. You know, it certainly didn't last year. So, but my point is that the SEC has a little bit of an advantage there because for the most part, their lesser teams aren't participating. Therefore, their chances of taking losses from the bottom feeders in their league is less. And you've seen the SEC win it, you know, three out of the last 5 years. So the SEC has done well in that challenge. You know, and the other thing about the SEC Big 12 Challenge is that I don't know the exact percentages, but it is so dominant and so leans so much towards the home team. Last year, the only instance in the 10 games in which the road team won was Kentucky winning at Kansas, which is bizarre in retrospect that that happened in the way it did. I think it was an 18-point margin for Kentucky against the eventual national champions. And that ended up being the game that swung it. So it was dramatic last year from that standpoint, but there was really only one good game, too. You have to have good finishes for these things to really stand out or pop, because if they're not close games, they're not going to be in the A block of SportsCenter or whatever. You know, they're not going to show highlights on HQ of games that weren't really that close. And honestly, the only close SEC Big 12 challenge game last year was Tennessee-Texas, and there were no highlights. It was awful. It was like a brick fest. So the quality of the games, I feel like, hasn't been as great in the SEC, you know, Big 12 deal.
Well, that's another thing that the SEC Big 12 did is, you know, they created some interesting matchups like Tennessee at Texas. You get Rick Barnes going back to Texas. I don't really know what you could do in the ACC Big 10 that replicates that. Although I would like to see Wake Forest play at Iowa while Steve Forbes is the coach. Like, he grew up in Iowa, so taking him back to his home state would be, you know, a cool little story. You mentioned that Kentucky-Kansas game. It is wild to think back. North Carolina and Kansas played in the national title game. Kentucky blew both of them out last season.
And lost in the first round.
And then lost to St. Peter's in the first round. So, yeah, ACC Big Ten Challenge again. It'll be November 28th, 29th, and the 30th, with the marquee game being North Carolina at Indiana. Before we get out of here, some recruiting news. Five-star point guard Robert Dillingham has committed to the University of Kentucky. You wrote the story on that. What do folks need to know about the latest heralded point guard to pledge his allegiance to John Calipari?
Yeah, it sounds like our 24/7 partners who have scouted his game pretty thoroughly see an electric scorer, somebody who's really dynamic with the ball in his hand, somebody who can fill it up and just get a ton of buckets. And so, I mean, in that sense, perhaps the most the comp that might come to mind recent years, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Dillingham is super slender, like SGA was. Definitely going to need to put on some muscle and such, but it's a big one for Kentucky. Gets their class up to number three at the moment, and it's really just a two-member class right now. The other one is Reed Shepard, who's also a five-star kid and a legacy prospect. You know, DJ Wagner is getting all the attention as a legacy prospect who might end up playing somewhere in the Bluegrass State, but for those who were watching Kentucky basketball, you know, in the Tubby Smith era, right? Jeff Shepard's a name they probably remember, and his son is with Dillingham in that class. So those are two of the best guards in the class. I mean, I don't know what they're going to add from a big perspective to replace Oscar, but that's a nice 1-2 punch they got there in the backcourt.
He was asked about playing with DJ Wagner and said he would love to. You know, so I think we could fit well together, and they obviously could because DJ's more of a combo. They'd be outstanding together, but I think most people at this point are assuming DJ Wagner is going to follow in his grandfather's footsteps and play for Kenny Payne at the University of Louisville, especially since his grandfather Milt Wagner is now on staff at the University of Louisville. But you know, as I've said plenty of times over the years, like don't count out John Calipari until he's actually like been eliminated from the recruiting process, because he's obviously got one of the most decorated histories of recruiting high level prospects, especially guards, in the history of the sport.
What if Cal hired DeJuan?
Like I was asked that by somebody. You know, I think you get to a point where you got two, like you get, you could really get it. Start complicating the family dynamics. If granddad's at Louisville, dad's at Kentucky, and now DJ being pulled in a couple of different directions. I don't know how much anybody wants that. Like Wani and the entire family have done a really like great job of normalizing DJ's amateur career to date. Like he doesn't do a lot of press. There's not, you know, he's not at some academy. You know, they didn't build something strictly around him the way Amani Bates' family did. Right. It's like, you know, Milt went to Camden High, and then Wani went to Camden High, and now DJ's going to Camden High. Arthur Barclay, who is Wani's lifelong high school, lifelong close, like best friend who played at Memphis with DeJuan, mm-hmm. who, you know, I got, you know, I was the beat writer back when everybody calls him OG. When OG was on campus, like I keep in touch with him to this day. Like he's still basically everybody who was involved in DeJuan Wagner's recruitment it's the same people who are involved in DJ Wagner's recruitment. So if they've gone so out of their way to keep things as normal as possible for DJ throughout this process, a process that can get really wild in a number of different ways. I think having granddad get hired at Louisville and then dad get hired at Kentucky. And now, you know, you got perhaps different people pulling, you know, this young phenomenal talent in different directions. That gets a little complicated in ways that I don't know the family would want to complicate it.
How about the fact that from the class of 2023, the number one prospect in both football and basketball is a third generation legacy name, Arch Manning, and obviously DJ Wagner. I mean, we'll see. There is some mixed opinions on whether or not, you know, Wagner will actually finish as the number one ranked prospect in the class. I mean, I was talking with Adam Finkelstein, and there is some debate there. I mean, GG Jackson is a guy who's in the running for that as well. And I mean, Justin Edwards, Xavier Booker, two guys that 24/7 has ranked as a 99, like GG Jackson and DJ Wagner. So, I mean, it's not a slam dunk, but that is fascinating to me that in both sports, the likely number one prospect is a third generation star.
Well, we're seeing it more than ever, I think, in the NBA draft especially, but I just think in sports in general, like if your parents or one of your parents was a professional athlete, you like start way ahead of everybody else, you know, on this path of trying to get there because you probably have great genes. Let's just start there. But also like you grew up around it, you know, you're like, it's not surprising to me that Charlie Woods is awesome at golf. It would almost be surprising to me if he weren't, you know, cause like you're Tiger Woods' kid. You grew up with a with a practice range in your backyard, got a simulator in the house. Your dad's the all-time greatest. You probably had a club in your hand since you could hold anything. Like, why wouldn't he be awesome at golf?
But by the same token, though, it's no slam dunk because, I mean, you were the Pele of Horn Lake, and I mean, yes. I haven't heard you discuss, you know, your children being the Pele of
Children. My children are not the Pele's of Horn Lake. You know what? Like, not to get way off subject, but my little guys, my oldest, he didn't really play sports at all. Like, we had him in everything, like, when he was five. Like, he's in baseball, he's in football, he's in soccer, and just nothing really took. He just nothing really grabbed him. But my little guys right now are, you know, they're in baseball and golf, but the pandemic really did, like, get in the way of that because we took 2 years away from baseball, you know, for my middle guy. And, you know, like, when you miss 2 years, like, age six and age seven of baseball, like, that's a big deal. Now, he's back playing now, and he likes it, and we're having fun with it. But I wonder how many, like, young kids, you know, just, like, you're missing a year at that age can really complicate what you're going to be going forward. You know, I played, you know, once I started playing baseball and soccer when I was, like, four and five, and I didn't stop playing until I wasn't good enough to do it anymore. And, and yet we have a whole age group of kids who got in, who's had their development interrupted. So, you know, right now I would bet my kids do not look like they're going to be the next Arch Mannings or DJ Wagners, but they have fun doing it. And it's a blast as a parent.
Yeah. Well, to your point, you helped me kind of brainstorm a little bit on this story I did before the draft. And you suggested talking to a former front office member for this story about pedigree prospects. And I hooked up with David Mintzberg, who used to be the director of scouting for the Grizzlies, went on to work for, you know, the Pistons and the Bucks as well. And so the story is still applicable. If you want to go read it, it's less than 10 days old. It was written in advance of the draft, but the themes are still relevant for the DJ Wagners of the world and moving forward, because this is only going to become more prevalent. And if you look at the top five picks in this year's draft, Paolo Banchero, mom played in the WNBA, dad played Division I college football. Chet Holmgren, dad played, you know, high major Division I basketball. Jabari Smith, dad played in the NBA. Keegan Murray, father played Division I basketball. And then number five, Jaden Ivey, his mom played in the WNBA, his dad played in the NFL.
So, yeah, I mean, look at Major League Baseball right now. You know, Fernando Tatis Jr., Jack Leiter, he's not in the majors, but like was a heralded prospect coming out of Vanderbilt. Like, you know, as someone who watches baseball every night, it's wild how often you look up and you go, oh, that's so-and-so's kid. Oh, I remember his father played. Like that is all over Major League Baseball now. And it's become a real, we've talked about this before, a real priority for front offices. I can't speak to NFL front offices so much because I don't know those people, but certainly NBA front offices, they do prioritize. Like, what did your mom do? What did your dad do? Were either of them a professional athlete? If so, that's a good place to start the conversation because the list of guys who have just been incredible coming from that pedigree is pretty lengthy at this point. Steph Curry, great example. Kobe Bryant, a great example. More recently, Jaren Jackson Jr., really good example. So yeah, I had not quite connected the DJ Wagner Arch Manning thing, but it is true. And DJ, you know, in less than a year, will become a third-generation McDonald's All-American, and that will be the first family to ever be three generations of McDonald's All-Americans. It's really an awesome, awesome story. And it's just based on my career and how it unfolded. Like, you know, I've known Milt for 20 years now, you know, and knew Wani when he was 17, 18 years old. And I don't know DJ, but I've obviously seen him play quite a bit. Like just a few years ago in Vegas when he was really young, you know, it was me and Dewan and Cal all sitting together watching DJ play in a gym in Vegas. And at that point, everybody just assumed like this is done. DJ's going to Kentucky to play for Cal. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Louisville hires Kenny Payne and Kenny Payne hires Milt Wagner. And now it looks like it's flipped the other direction. But either way, the point, Robert Dillingham has committed to Kentucky. And that's another in a long list of heralded point guards to play for John Calipari. It started really at Memphis when he would get Darius Washington, Tyreke Evans, DeJuan Wagner, Derrick Rose. And then the list at Kentucky is obviously ridiculous, starting with that first Kentucky class that included John Wall. So if you haven't seen the story on Robert Dillingham's commitment to Kentucky, you can find it at CBSSports.com. David Cobb wrote it, I believe, on Friday. Let's get out of here. I appreciate your time. Thank you for being here. Shouts to Devin Downey. Shouts to Chester, South Carolina. Shouts to Hawk. Shouts to Larnell. And thank you guys for listening. I Own College Basketball Podcast. If you're not subscribed, please go subscribe anywhere you subscribe to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts. While you're there, 5 stars and leave a nice review. Type some words. There's more of us than there are of them, and it needs to be reflected in the comments. And while you're doing that, I'll tell you, we will talk to you again real, real soon, later on this week. Till then, take care.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.